and the conservation of energy and momentum, and using the ideal hydro stress, rho plus P U nu plus P G mu nu. And remember, we said that the rest mass is insignificant compared to its internal energy because we're taking the ultra-relativistic limit. So, in other words, say rho epsilon is much, much greater than rho naught. Rho naught epsilon is much, much greater than rho naught. And so we consider only the ultra-relativistic equation of state. And so we can then put these equations of motion in conservation form. So psi is zero in this case. And we find that, remember these are state vectors, Q is equal to the vector tau s, F is equal to S S V plus P, and psi is zero. So following the same methodology that we went through Tuesday, we can calculate the eigenstructure of the system and thus derive how we calculate the rho numerical flux and how then that gives us the update procedure for the evolution equations. And note that also we do the reconstruction with the primitive variables, and the primitive variables you can take to be the density and the velocity, or the pressure and the velocity. So I'll try to differentiate the primitive variable vector from the pressure by this underscore. And so if you go through all the ugly derivations, you find that that rho matrix, I think you should be able to see it right, yeah, looks something like this. Where the matrix is, of course, A11, A12, A21, A22. You can show that this, so in order to take, these are non-trivial to derive also. Minus 2 beta plus 4 beta squared plus gamma minus 1 tau over 4 beta squared tau squared plus gamma minus 1 times tau squared minus s squared. And this is all square rooted. And you can derive these from inverting the from finding P of Q and then just taking the derivative of that. And it's the same denominator. So that gives you the eigen matrix. And then it's easy to diagonalize that and find the eigenvalues. which I guess I didn't realize the notes are just a general solution with no simplification. I should have simplified it for you guys. Is it looks simpler than that, I believe. And so if, still in general, the right, you can, so in order to choose a unique right eigenvector, people select the first element to be 1 and then solve for the second element. So y plus or minus, just define as lambda plus or minus minus a11 over a12. Okay, so we've got the eigenvalues, the right eigenvector. Remember that crazy term in the row flux looks something like this. So we have this now, we have this now, and now we need to find omega. And remember, we find omega by through the jump conditions. Okay, so what we need to do is we need to invert the matrix of right eigenvectors, so where the right eigenvector fills up each column of that matrix. So we invert it, we slap it on this side, and then we can read off what omega is. And carrying out all the yucky algebra, we yield this simple solution where the square brackets denote the element of that state vector. So you can hopefully see what we've done in that we've inverted that matrix, right? So probably someone could just tell me what this D, I'm sure you've all inverted a matrix before, so you recognize the structure, so someone could probably tell me what this D is, right? Sorry, this should be a 2. Lots of brackets in this guy. Oops. Let's see if I got that right. Any guesses for what D is? Yeah. I should be able to write down. Okay. So before, when we looked at Berger's equation, the conserved variable is the primitive variable. Here, our primitive variables are different, and we do most of the manipulation of the variable in the numerical algorithm with the primitive variable, but we need to, but we really evolve the conserved variable. So we know how tau and s are defined in terms of rho and v. I'll write this down again. Where w is equal to 1 minus v squared, and v is equal to u of r, or wait, are we doing this? It's u of x over u of t. Okay, so this is the Lorentz factor. It goes from 1 to infinity as you get faster and faster. And this is the coordinate velocity of the flow. Okay. So our primitive variables are rho and v. The state equation gives us p in terms of rho. So we know how to calculate tau and s. It's a little tricky to find rho and v in terms of tau and s because of the Lorentz factor. Okay, notice that it's not a linear relationship anymore, because tau and s are proportional to just rho and p to the 1 power. That'd be really easy to invert, but the v complicates things. For this simple problem, though, it's pretty straightforward to solve. And so we have the solution to the inversion, algebraic conversion problem. Now I think I didn't define beta, right? And the other density looks a little bit simpler. Well, you just, once you know the pressure, you know the density. And V, once you know everything else, V is just this. So really, all the yucky terms are in P. All right, so you calculate, you do the reconstruction process with the primitives, rho and v. You calculate the matrix, the eigenvalues, the jumps, and you calculate the numerical flux. You update q, then you solve for p, rho and v using these equations, and then you repeat the process ad infinitum until you want to stop the simulation. Any questions so far? If you look at regular fluids, so not ultra relativistic fluids, this process, as I mentioned earlier, it becomes more complicated. You can't write closed form solutions for p, rho, and v in terms of the conserved variables. So you have to solve numerically this inversion process. Okay. Yeah.
Just a small detail first, like on the upper line where you have r squared minus 1, is r plus or r minus?
Sorry.
about this whole stuff here, that, like, in nature, where do you encounter these ultra-relativistic fluids? What kind of stuff do you, like, model?
So this would be really hot material. Okay, so epsilon is proportional to the temperature of the fluid. So you could use this in to model jets. You could also very relativistic collapse. I'll maybe touch on this at the end of the lecture today. So this limit naturally happens as you compress a fluid severely. So for instance, if you take a neutron star and you squish it really, really, really hard, you can drive the interior to become very hot and it naturally enters this ultra-relativistic state. No one has, I think, seen that happen in nature, or any consequence of that in nature. So, so I would probably say the most likely candidate for this is for these equations to be useful in nature are in jets. It's a good question. All right. Okay, so I'm going to show you a few movies of these equations at the end. I don't want to break the lecture two times, so I'll just reserve the movies towards the end. We'll be talking about those evolutions of Berger's equation, etc. But I want to now start talking about static solutions of Einstein's equations coupled to fluids, and also MHD evolution, so that we can learn how to solve these exciting astrophysics systems like jets. Jets are powered by pressure gradients and also magnetic fields, and there's also are a component of gamma ray bursts. So there are long and short gamma ray bursts. The long ones are thought to be from massive stellar collapse. And so the star collapses, forms a black hole, and this accretion disk then powers this powerful collimated jet that is driven through the star. And magnetic fields are thought to contribute to that power. And however, that's an unsolved problem. No one has done that from the very start of the collapse. So no one's calculated the simulation all the way through. So that's a very important outstanding problem to solve. And we can solve that if we have the GR-MHD equations at hand. So pretty much that, just those equations themselves are enough for you to do the simulation on a computer. You just need enough resolution and enough time to evolve those equations. So these are very useful equations that you can explore a wide range of phenomenon with. So now you know the numerical techniques to solve them, and just apply for a supercomputer allocation and you can start doing these modern simulations yourself. So some people are interested in nuclear physics. So people hope to see binary neutron stars merge in space through gravitational waves. And if you measure the gravitational waves, if you simulate these objects and you vary the equation of state, you'll find that the gravitational waves change when you change the equation of state. So that tells us that we could maybe match the gravitational waves that we see from these neutron star mergers onto an equation of state theory. And so some people have even hoped to discover strange matter cores in neutron stars, or various different superfluid states in neutron stars. Some people think that maybe there are quark stars out there that are in these strange quark multiplet states. And so quark stars are thought to would be even denser than neutron stars. So you compress. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the evolution of compact objects. If you have a white dwarf, and so the white dwarf is pressure supported by electron degeneracy pressure. If you compress that even further, the electrons and the protons collide and form neutrons, and so you form a neutron star. And then the neutron star cools and forms a Fermi, fills up all the lower Fermi levels, and that serves as its pressure. So that's the Fermi pressure. So there's condensed matter for you. And then you've got, so I imagine, I don't know much about quark stars, but imagine you compress it even further, it becomes even, the neutrons, I guess, change state and disassociate into quarks, into a quark fluid, and then it's supported by, I don't know, I guess, I mean, quarks aren't really fermions, right? They're, I don't know. So I imagine they don't form quite a similar state as the neutrons. But so there's pressure support somehow, and then eventually, if you squash the quark star more, you'd form a black hole. But so if we saw two quark stars merge, that would look very different in the gravitational wave signal than two neutron stars merging or two black holes merging. And also, we think maybe we've begun to see binaries merge with neutron stars. So a candidate for a short gamma ray burst is a neutron star around a black hole, or even two neutron stars. So the idea is that you form this disk or rotating matter distribution that then collapses into a black hole, and that launches a jet, which is a short gamma ray burst. So with these equations, again, you could simulate these things and help us predict what these really exotic equations of state are. And these equations, so the state of matter that exists in neutron stars cannot be found anywhere else in nature. We can't explore this part of phase space because it's cold, it's too cold and too dense. So if we try to achieve baryonic densities at this density, what we would do is we would shoot nuclei, heavy nuclei together, like at RIC, the relativistic heavy ion collider, and we would form this quark gluon plasma. That wouldn't be cold, that'd be really hot. So much hotter than what exists in a neutron star. So neutron stars are the only place in the universe that really samples as part of parameter space. So gravitational waves are pretty much our only hope in understanding details of that, because we're not going to hop on a spaceship and go and visit a neutron star anytime soon. So that's a very exciting thing we can measure with gravitational waves. So, on the topic of neutron stars, let's figure out how to solve for their structure. Great. I can erase this, right? So when you think of a neutron star, what do you think of? No one has any idea what a neutron star looks like?
Very dense.
Very what?
Dense.
Dense. Okay. Does it look? Do you think it looks topologically like other stars? It's not a donut, right? Spherical. Okay. So maybe a good approximation. Make our lives easy. You assume that's spherically symmetric. Okay. So, and also, do you imagine neutron stars to be highly dynamic? Is it going to be like, you know, shooting off? Well, they can be very dynamic. So that's not very. It has a magnetosphere, has magnetic field, strong magnetic fields, and they can pulse. And you've probably heard, there's a crust on the surface of neutron stars, and there can be, it can suddenly break and cause these neutron star quakes, and that can launch a powerful X-ray and radio source. So they're not as simple as we're going to portray them today, but we'll just assume for simplicity, we'll start with the simplest case, and then you can always later, not in this course, but some other time, make them a little bit more complicated. So we'll assume spherical symmetric equations and also time-independent equations. So those are three killing, in the vernacular of GR, or differential geometry, that represents three killing fields, which are... These are the killing fields. So theta and phi are just the polar and azimuthal variables in spherical coordinates. So in practice, this just means that any of these derivatives on any of the fields is zero. Okay. And so we only have things functions of R. And to take a perfectly general spherically symmetric metric, we'll consider this one. There are other spherically symmetric metrics, but they're more complicated. We need not consider those. And we have... So remember, all of these functions are variable are functions of only radius. Okay. And also, I'm deviating a little bit from the notes here. The notes introduce this rho hat variable. And actually, they make a mistake at one point, and so I'll avoid its introduction. You don't need to use it. So that's why there will be a difference in my lecture then in the notes. Yes?
You said that time independent, it's allowed to spin and stuff, but it's not allowed to deform in a funny way or something.
Yeah, exactly. Real stars can spin, real stars can deform. These are going to be the idealized versions of those stars.
So this star is not even allowed to spin around its axis.
Correct. Yeah. That would mean that right. So we also set v theta v phi and also vr to be zero. If vr wasn't zero, then it would pulsate. Okay. And it's not spinning. So V theta and V phi are 0, 2. That rotation, so you would have to choose a, if you wanted it to maintain axisymmetry then, So that would then make that would eliminate this killing field, for instance, if you assume that the rotation was about z. Then you would have to choose your v phi profile as a function of r, and that would introduce this kind of like a pressure term in your equations, right? Because it's instead of the star solely being supported by pressure, you would also be supported by rotation now. So that would the rotation of the star would support it. Okay. So we're only going to be considering pressure supported stars for this example. So now you have Einstein's equations, you have the metric, so you know how to evaluate the Einstein tensor. You have the stress energy tensor, so you know how to evaluate the right-hand side. And you can just plug all that into the Einstein's equations, and you get this. So the prime and represents differentiation with respect to radius, r. So we have b double prime over 2b minus b prime over 4b times a prime over a plus b prime over b minus a prime over ra. And this structure here is very common in spherically symmetric metrics. Just like you'll see that all the time. The right hand side is minus 4 pi rho a. We have minus 1 plus r over 2a minus a prime over a plus b prime over b plus 1 over a is equal to minus 4 pi rho r squared. And then the final equation is b double prime over 2a plus b prime over 4a times a prime over a plus b prime over b minus b prime over ra is equal to minus 4 pi rho plus 3p all times b. The relatively simple equations. That takes a while to derive this. But you haven't done GR until you've done like a dozen of these things, so you gotta get your hands dirty. Once you do a few, it'll, you know, become easier. But you guys do, you know, field theory calculations all the time, right? So this is trivial, right? Do you guys use I'm sorry, I always say guys. I don't mean to be sexist or anything. But do you all use Mathematical or Maple to perform these operations? Who uses Mathematica? Oh, okay. I won't tell MapleSoft that. You're in Maple country here. In addition to Einstein's equations, we also have the energy conservation equation, and that gives us this guy or girl. And this is the equation that's wrong in the notes, or I think is wrong in the notes. I could be wrong, but I did my PhD thesis on this, so I'm probably right. It's a simple typo. In the notes, it's rho hat. And rho hat is taken to be rho plus p. So that would mean that it would be 2p plus rho, but I'm pretty sure it's p over rho. So knowing the space-time and this constraint, you can solve for the time component of the four velocity. And that is just minus square root b. So the four velocity just looks like this. Minus square root b 0, 0, 0. And you can simplify these equations quite a bit. You can introduce this mass function. Some people call it the mass aspect ratio. And it's, the mass aspect function. And it would be the mass that you would feel. So, for instance, you know that space and matter are all intertwined and it's hard to separate the gravitational source from the material source. But if you're, you know, if you're in a space-time, you're affecting the space-time because you're massive. I don't have to say, you know, you're heavy, you may well be fit, but you have some mass. So. So you're curving space-time, but let's say you're orbiting this star. Okay, so what would be the mass that you would feel that you're orbiting? Like you somehow leave breadcrumbs. I don't know how you would do this, but you calculate your orbit, and using Kepler's law, you would derive that and you're orbiting at some radius r, and so you would calculate that your exterior, that orbit encompasses a mass equal to m of r, and the m of r is r over 2 times 1 minus 1 over a, where a is the metric here. So if you So, for instance, if you happen to be in a strictly symmetric star within it, embedded in it, and this is the solution to that space-time, then this would be the mass interior to your radius. And naturally, the gradient of that mass function is this. Okay, so you've got, note that you have a contribution from the internal energy density too. Okay, energy curves, okay, contributes to space-time curvature. And this equation plus others gives you this equation. So dpdr is equal to minus rho plus p times m plus 4 pi r cubed p over r times r minus 2m. Fortunately, these stars don't have radii shorter than 2m, else this would explode, right? So this is the r equals 2m is the Schwarzschild radius of a black hole, but neutron stars are not as compressed or so their radii are larger, so dp over dr is always finite. So these two equations are typically what are used to calculate the neutron star solutions. And these equations were derived by Oppenheimer and Volkoff and solved by Tolman in a companion paper. You've probably heard of Oppenheimer. He happened to direct the Los Alamos project that made, you know, the first atomic bombs. He's also a very prominent astrophysicist at Caltech. And that's where they derived these equations. This was this was in the 30s. This was before the project. So some people call them the Oppenheimer-Volkoff equations. Others call them the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff equations. Actually, no one calls them that. They call them the OV
or TOV equations.
Yeah. So the original paper you'll see is Oppenheimer-Volkoff, but if you actually open up the journal, Tolman has a paper right after theirs, and it tells you how to solve the equations. And gives you examples and kind of explores a little bit. So I think it was kind of a joint project, and I don't know the exact history of it, but. So what is the solution procedure? So you notice that you have you really have three variables now that you're solving for, rho, p, and m. Right, you have two equations, one for m and one for p, so how do you get rho? Well, so you always have to, you have to write down an equation of state. And we're all familiar with the ideal gas equation of state. Right, so rho naught epsilon times gamma minus 1 is equal to p, this is the adiabatic index. This is the rest mass density, this is the internal energy, specific internal energy density, rho, to remind you, is rho naught plus rho naught epsilon. However, this doesn't give you rho, right? You need to know rho naught, so you need another one. And this is called the polytropic equation of state. Okay, so the procedure, since you can now write these equations in terms of rho naught, so let me solve it for you. Rho naught plus rho epsilon, this is equal to rho naught plus p over gamma minus 1. P is also equal to this. So you've got rho naught plus k rho naught gamma over gamma minus 1. Okay. So you can choose to parameterize these solutions by the central rest mass density of the star. So that's what I would recommend you do. Choose rho naught at r equals 0. Let's call that the central density. Okay, and there's a boundary condition. How much mass is within r equals 0? Yep, 0. Can be no matter within a set of size 0. So then, so you have a boundary condition. So if you're curious, dp dr is 0 at the origin 2, because it has to be analytic. And dm dr, it's given by the central, you know, the boundary condition for dmdr is given by the central density, or it's actually 0 there, so it has to be smooth. And then m of r is 0, and p of r is given by this equation. P of r equals 0 is given by that equation. And then you just integrate from the origin out until. So you integrate from r equals 0 until you reach a point where rho naught is less than 0, or p. Okay, so what? So the solution will look something like this. Let's say it's log rho naught. So it'll actually have this really really sharp feature, just plummets to zero. And since you're doing this numerically, you'll actually overshoot zero and become negative. And so what you should do then in that case, if you want to find the real radius of the star, you need to backtrack, use a smaller step size until you actually hit rho equals zero. And that's the real radius of the star, r star. Okay. And then the mass of the star is equal to the mass function at r star. Okay. And hope to get to the movies today. So remember, rho star is a parameterizes a family of these solutions. And also, I want to note that these equations are valid for describing quark stars, neutron stars, white dwarfs. The only difference is in the equation of state. So you have to change that. But then everything else is the same. Okay. As far as I know about quark stars, I don't know, maybe it's more exotic. Oh, we don't know the equation of state of these stars. Yeah. there are theoretical expectations for these equations of state, but yeah, we don't know them. So you would, right? The solution that you would derive for a quark star or white dwarf, the equation of a white dwarf, equation of state for a white dwarf may be known. I'm not an expert in white dwarfs, but yeah, these are very simple equation of states, equations of state. More sophisticated ones that are based on better nuclear theory are usually come in the form of tables. Okay, so you have, because you have to solve these complicated integrals, so you can only do that numerically, so you don't have closed form solutions for these equations of state, so you have to form these numerical tables. And then in order to find, in order to evaluate the pressure at points in between the values in those tables, you have to interpolate between those values. So it becomes a little bit more complicated. If you do solve the TOB equations over different values of the central density, you'll find that the mass starts off low and then rises, reaches a peak, and then kind of oscillates like that. Okay, this is the maximum allowed mass of that neutron star, the Chandrasekhar limit. And here these are stable stars. And over here they're unstable stars. You can solve the TOB equations fine on the right hand side here, but if you were to evolve it, the numerical errors in your evolution equation would perturb the star and it would drive that star to the stable branch. Okay. If you plot the mass of these stars versus the radius of the star, you get this interesting feature. So you go from large radius, these are the really sparse stars. So low density, but you know, so they become really large. As you increase density, so here, this is the central density, this is where now I'm drawing this diagram and increasing central density. And you hit the peak, and then you start spiraling inward. And all the extrema of these, of this spiral feature line up. Okay. Actually, I'm wrong. They don't line up. The first one doesn't line up with the rest, but the rest do line up because of these wiggles, the asymptotes. So, I'm sorry. I drew this a little bit wrong. Wait. Or am I right? Wait. I think I'm right, actually. I'm sorry. I think they are all at the same central. I'll confirm that and tell you for sure tomorrow. I think they all line up. Anyway, the locations of these extrema indicate when an extra unstable mode enters the solution. Okay, so here this is stable. So this portion of the line are stable solutions up until this extrema. Then there's an unstable mode introduced into the solution. Okay. And notice that the unstable modes can be at higher central density, but at the same mass as a stable solution. Okay, so you'd have something with the same mass, but it would be squashed up more, it'd be more dense. You would have smaller radius. So that spiral actually goes on and on forever, which is interesting. And so what my thesis was about was I was perturbing the stable stars and making them look like unstable stars. So I drove stars on the stable branch to the unstable branch, and I tuned the initial data such that it emulated the unstable solution for as long as it could. So what I was doing was, in a sense, tuning away the unstable mode of the solution. Okay. And you can write down, so this is observed in a few spherically symmetric relativistic solutions, and also expected in higher dimensional systems that the So now P is just a parameter of the initial data, okay? It's a parameter of the perturber that perturbs a star. And T is the time on unstable branch, let's say. So we find that it's proportional to some sigma times log of P minus P star, where P star is the threshold parameter. So if P was exactly P star to infinite precision, you would stay on the unstable branch forever. Okay, that would mean that we've fully tuned the initial data to eliminate the unstable solution exactly. So if you were to plot this, delta t versus log p minus p star, we could see this straight line. Or, so I actually plot this minus that. Okay. So I have like 2 minutes. How about do you mind looking maybe for 5 minutes at these shock tube solutions? It shouldn't take very long. And then tomorrow I'll continue on with the neutron stars. And then the MHD equations. Okay. So this is the neutron star stuff. Okay, so remember yesterday we were looking at the solutions of Berger's equation, or the, you know, how to solve Berger's equation, and we okay. So there were various ways of solving the equations. We recommend the finite volume techniques, but there are also finite difference techniques. And I said that the finite difference techniques didn't perform as well as the finite volume ones, but here we can actually demonstrate this for you. So Berger's equation, so Q0. So these are the this is the exact solution of Berger's. This is not Berger's. I'm sorry. I want the Riemann ones, right? So this is the exact Riemann solution of this problem. So we start with a high left state, low right state, so it leads to a shock. And that's the exact solution, so it's just this discontinuity that is propagated. If we use rho, the rho solver, so this will be the exact solution in yellow dots, and the rho solution with blue dots. And let's see if I can zoom in. So you can see that the rho solution is not as sharp as the exact solution. Okay, so it's not perfect, but it looks pretty good. It follows the same shock speed and is relatively sharp. Okay, so rho does a good job. And in terms of rare fraction, so we have a low left state and a high right state. You also see, you know, the exact solution is sharper, but the rho solver works pretty well. Now for the ultra-relativistic equations, no, I'm sorry, this is still Berger's equation, but this is a Gaussian pulse now, okay? So it's being advected to the right, and it steepens because one of the earlier days, you know, the right side is moving slower than the left side, so everything kind of piles up. So this is the exact behavior if you were to solve for with rho, you would and I'm sorry, I made another mistake. Okay, so this is using the rho scheme. So the original method used the rho solver. This is with a conservative form, but finite differencing. So you can see that this jump here, there's some difference between the two, and the conservative form finite difference scheme is slightly within the better solution. If you were to finite difference it not in conservative form, you would get an altogether different shock speed. Okay, so the location of the shock evolves differently. Actually, stays put, and it doesn't really move much. So if you are to finite difference something, if you have to do it, you should put the equations in conservative form. That way you'll get the correct Rankine Fugonio shock solutions. And if you want, though, a second order finite difference solution using the conservative form, you would get this Gibbs phenomenon. Okay, so it's at the same level here, and the shock speed is the same, but you notice that the finite difference solution undershoots, and this is classic Gibbs phenomenon. You get these oscillations about the discontinuity, and these don't converge away. Okay, so hopefully I've convinced you that the methods that we learned are the best out of the ones that at least we've examined here. So it resolves the shock, it doesn't lead to excessive oscillations about the discontinuity, it doesn't lead to undershoots, and so we expect good physical solutions out of this method. For instance, if you were to actually maybe implement the second order conservative form finite difference equations, and you got this undershoot, you could solve for negative pressures, you could get negative pressures or densities out of your solution, and that could ruin your simulation. So that just doesn't make any sense. Okay, so tomorrow I'll finish up what I started about neutron stars, and then we'll go on to the MHD equations. Okay, thanks. Does anyone have any questions before we break off?
Yes. I just said that undershoot for the negative pressures could be like really heavy. But since it's very localized, it's just that little region where it's undershooting. It doesn't seem like it should be
a big problem.
Yeah.
You're right. You could. There are most simulation codes. If a problem like that does arise, they implement this floor, where it's a minimum positive value for the pressure and density. So you do all of your update, and then you look for any of these negative values, and then you correct them. You can also sometimes you get superluminal velocities, and so you have to fix those values too. And so there, most if not all codes have these fix-up routines that fix up these values. So yeah, you're right. It's not the end of end of the world. But these shocks form everywhere generically in your solution. And so it would, if you used one of these worst methods, it would lead to these failures or these unphysical values all over the domain. And your fix-up routines are always unphysical operations. It introduces pretty significant error into your solution. And so if you had to do that everywhere, then you would have big problems. You would not be conserving energy, for instance, and you would be changing the thermodynamic state of your fluid. So you want a method that is robust, especially in these simple test problems. So these are not very difficult examples for a code to solve. So if the method doesn't work well in these cases, then has a little hope for solving the tougher problems that we hope to simulate. That was a good question. Okay, well, I guess I'll see you tomorrow. And there's a lab this afternoon.